We at the Cape York Partnership acknowledge that this podcast is produced on the traditional lands of First Nations people, and we pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging.
We should keep our country.
The Indigenous box has been ticked, and we've solved the problem.
That we cannot give Indigenous Australians up without giving up much of our identity.
To actually recognise that
you're booing you because you're acting like a Jew,
rather on race and support.
You have set up a shame for us.
We need to know as a mature country be able to.
The future where this Parliament resolves that the injustice is in a.
You know what? It's time to listen.
Welcome to Time to Listen, a podcast that gives a space and a platform to the voices of First Nations people and those working in Indigenous affairs. You are with your host, Isaac McCarthy, and this week we are proceeding with the second part of our interview with human rights lawyer and Cape York Leaders Program alumna, Marijke Bassani. On the last episode, we were introduced to Marijke, and she explained the discriminatory issues that have affected her as a First Nations woman and LGBTQI+ person. This week, Marijke provides an outline of issues that affect First Nations people, particularly First Nations women, on a wider scale. It is important to acknowledge, however, that Marijke does not intend nor seek to speak on behalf of anyone other than herself. She speaks exclusively from her own experience. This is a point that she stressed in the previous episode and applies to our discussion in this episode as well. I also acknowledge that the content of this conversation may trigger strong or unwelcome emotions, feelings, or states of mind. Marijke and I discuss matters of trauma and mental illness. If you do find this triggering, there are avenues of support available to you. You can call Lifeline on 131114. I have included other options for support in the show notes. I thank Marijke for her time and you, the audience, for taking the time to listen. So what misperceptions and misconceptions of First Nations women, the difference there being the conviction of one's opinion, do you think that modern racism has created?
Oh my goodness. Okay, that we all look the same. So Australia has, this is on us too, this is on our country. We convey to the world and the rest of the country a very particular type of Aboriginal person, you know, a particular look, right? Usually this person is dark skin, you know, often associated with the Northern Territory. But Indigenous people in Australia, First Nations people, particularly women, oh, and men as well, you know, we are all so diverse looking. We're so diverse. But I feel that a misperception and a misconception of First Nations peoples in Australia, not just women, is that, you know, the fairer the complexion, the sharper the nose, or the more attractive you are perceived by Western society, the less, you know, Indigenous or First Nations you are considered to be. Because for some reason, Indigenous women, we're not permitted to be attractive. And if we are attractive, it's not because of our Indigenous blood. It's because of our colonial blood, which is a really, really hurtful thing to say. You know, and so I would say, Indigenous people, First Nations people are so aesthetically diverse, and this has actually always been the case, even prior to contact and colonization, because we were already trading with other people, other cultures and other nations, you know what I mean? And so that diversity was always there, but most Australians aren't aware of this. They think that diversity happened after colonization, but it didn't. It was always there. We're all so diverse looking.
Thank you for sharing that information and also your experiences of racism, because I understand that wouldn't be a particularly easy thing to revisit in memory. Remote First Nations communities, for example, those in Cape York, are separated from Australian society and therefore largely invisible to the non-Indigenous Australian population. Do you think this leads to a lack of empathy for First Nations people and creates misperceptions of them?
Yes, I think so, but I don't think this just applies to remote or First Nations people from remote communities. I think this also applies to even, you know, First Nations peoples in more urban areas and more developed regions of the country. There's definitely a lack of empathy for us, and there are definitely existing misperceptions. I think for me, what I consider very frustrating is my entire life I have had negative interaction after negative interaction with non-Indigenous people when it comes to my race. And to be honest, it gets very, very difficult to maintain an open mind and to continue to give everyone the benefit of the doubt, because I know that that is not returned, that same open-mindedness, that same giving everyone the benefit of the doubt, because many non-Indigenous people will have just one negative experience with a First Nations person and then completely write off an entire community that is so inherently diverse. But Indigenous people are expected to continue to remain open-minded about white people and non-Indigenous people and to continue to give everyone benefit of the doubt. But it's really difficult when that is not returned.
In an interview a few years ago, you said the following, and I'm paraphrasing here, excellence is the best deterrent to racism. In effect, what I believe you're saying here is that if you focus on being the best possible person that you can be and then demonstrate that to others, then there can be no basis or reason for racism. I understand, based on a conversation that we've had prior to this, that your views have now changed on the matter. Please elaborate.
I actually giggle at this comment now. I giggle because I no longer believe that excellence is the best deterrent to racism and even sexism for that matter. How do I know this? Because I've reached a level of success that only a very small percent of people in my profession achieve, in the legal profession. And despite my professional and academic accomplishments and success, I still face racism. Racism from other lawyers, from legal academics, from clients, and from members of, you know, the general public and mainstream community more broadly. Because when I walk out that door and step out into the big world, the first thing non-Indigenous Australians see is my race and then my gender. And these two fundamental aspects of my identity that are visible then heavily influence how people interact with me moving forward, whether it's in a social setting, a casual setting, or a professional setting.
So I understand what you're saying there to be that despite how excellent or despite the success that you found within your own life, people will still look straight to your skin color before they even bother looking to what you've been able to achieve and what you've been able to demonstrate, regardless of what race you are, or regardless of your ethnicity, I should say. However, I am wondering though, does it help with your own self-confidence, self-esteem, and you know self-respect that, you know, in achieving all of these things, it makes people's comments or misconceptions of you insignificant because you know that they're not true. You have no reason to be ashamed of yourself because you've already disproven what they're saying.
Definitely. I mean, the thing is though, it's a lot easier said than done as well, particularly if this is happening several times a day, you know, several times a week. It gets really heavy. To give you an example, I guess, like really, really simple examples of this, what we're talking about. It would be great to go to Coles or Woolies and not be followed by the fake shopper or not be asked for a receipt, you know, or ask for my bag to be searched when there's someone right next to me who totally said they have only one avocado when they've got four in the self-checkout area, you know, or they've completely not swiped the toilet paper and the milk. And I'm swiping everything and I'm being very honest. But they're missing this individual over here and their behavior and what they're doing because they're looking at me because they think I'm going to do that, even though I'm on great money. I can afford these things. You know what I mean? Like, that's just a really basic, simple example of what we're talking about. You know, another one that's quite confronting is just being able to walk out in public in attire that is visibly Indigenous, you know, whether that's a Deadly Choices shirt or, you know, a shirt with the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander flag on it or something with, you know, it has an Indigenous design that's visible. It would be great to be able to wear that in public and not feel like or not encounter harassment and abuse. I mean, last year, and we talked about this, you know, a few days ago, Isaac, and I told you how last year I was walking down South Pine Road at Everton Park in Brisbane with my, you know, Aboriginal flag shirt. I was actually on my way to therapy. A group of young non-Indigenous men drove past and called me the N-word and the C-word. And, you know, that's not an unusual experience. And these are the encounters that we have with the public when we wear anything that suggests, even suggests that we are proud to be First Nations, you know. I've even been death stared in the shops, or I've had people walk past me and say things to me, mumble things to me under their breath, loud enough for me to hear that they're upset at me, but not loud enough for me to hear what they actually said. That's also a really common experience. And First Nations people, you know, I'm not the first First Nations person to experience this. Women in particular become targets to this kind of behavior more so than men. And I've even had First Nations brothers, you know, admit that to me. It's these are things that are commonly experienced by First Nations women when we wear anything that suggests that we are proud of being First Nations.
And I suppose that experience, the one you just described when you were walking down the road, that crystallizes your sentiment. I mean, it doesn't matter that in that scenario that you are a human rights lawyer, that you're studying a PhD, that you've moved away from home and become, you know, independent outside, all these achievements, those people still just saw your indigeneity and decided to use
and my gender
and your gender,
yeah,
and decided to use the most vulgar terms that they could.
Exactly. And I guess just to push the point that at the end of the day, the reason I no longer, you know, that sentiment no longer resonates with me is because when I walk out the door, I'm reduced to my race and my gender. I guess for me the focus now is more on not internalizing that language, not internalizing those encounters, and staying, you know, in my light and on my path, knowing that I don't need anyone, I don't need external validation. I validate myself. My community validates me, my family validates me. I don't need external validation from complete strangers.
Do you find that you're receiving in equal measure support from non-Indigenous people in your current communities, whether it be your workplace, your places of study, places where you live, your friend circles? Do you think that within Australia, whilst this racism clearly exists, that there are people out there who are also trying to make First Nations people not feel discriminated against?
I think so. Definitely. I think there are a lot of people who are doing it on a surface level, and it's very performative. It lacks depth because truly at the end of the day, to unpack racism and our racial, you know, our unconscious racial biases, it actually involves very personal individual work. It involves having self-awareness and challenging yourself and your own beliefs and your own constitution on a daily bloody basis. It's hard, confronting work. And I think there are a lot of non-Indigenous people out there who are engaging in what I would call performative allyship. Those who I have encountered in my life who are not performative in their allyship aren't performative because they have forged genuine, healthy, strong, respectful connections with First Nations people in their life, whether it was in their family, you know, or via their partner, children, or in the workplace. I feel that the best allies in Australia are the best because they're able to draw from this very personal relationship that they have with another First Nations person in their life. And I think that that's what it takes for there to be real empathy, because, you know, we think about that loved one or that person, you know, we're so down for, who's so dope, and we really like them and we really respect them. It takes that, like, for the empathy to be genuine and real and to lead to action. Because I'm not interested in your passive empathy. I want action. None of us are interested in passive empathy. We want action. And in order for that action to take place, I feel that there needs to be a connection to someone, First Nations, in their life. Part of that involves challenging people in your circle and in your family and at your workplace who are perpetuating these really harmful beliefs about First Nations peoples, beliefs that are myths, they're not factually correct. And true allyship is having that uncomfortable conversation with your boss or others in your family. You know, it's, you know, having those uncomfortable conversations, the kinds that are filled with awkward silences that might potentially risk that connection being severed. But that's what it takes. That's the very personal work that it takes.
The topic of intergenerational trauma is finding its way into the public discussion, especially that which pertains to Indigenous affairs. Just briefly, for those who have not heard the term before, could you please explain what intergenerational trauma is?
I probably would like to begin by saying that intergenerational trauma is one of those topics that can't really be discussed briefly or generically, and to attempt to do so would be doing a grave disservice to the complexities of intergenerational trauma itself. But for the sake of those listening today, I will say this. Intergenerational trauma, it's a very heavy subject, and one that is often re-traumatizing for many First Nations peoples all over the world, not just in Australia. It's also re-traumatizing for myself, and providing examples of intergenerational trauma is difficult. It's not an academic exercise for First Nations peoples because it actually requires opening up about very real personal traumatic experiences that have happened and which continue to happen, not only to us, but to our families and to our communities. I think that is probably one of the biggest misperceptions, conceptions, whatever you want to call it, about intergenerational trauma. It's very much alive, it's ongoing, it's not an historical concept, you know, something from the past that is no longer active and which no longer impacts First Nations peoples. That could not be further from the truth. Intergenerational trauma is only historical in the sense that it stems from colonization and the very brutal and systematic violence First Nations people experienced when the British attempted to invade us. That pain and suffering is then passed on from generation to generation to generation until someone has the mental capacity and the resources and tools to break that pattern and to end that pain and suffering. And that is an act that is much easier said than done because of the sacrifices one has to make in order to end the cycle of intergenerational trauma in the family. You know, we're dealing with deeply, deeply ingrained harmful patterns that began more than 200 years ago when Australia was first invaded by the British. These patterns are then fed by colonialism's oppressive systems and structures that exist in our society today. So, for example, police brutality, deaths in custody, missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, domestic violence, child sex abuse, sexual assault, etc. These are all examples of trauma that continue to feed our pain and suffering and which make healing from intergenerational trauma very, very difficult, to say the least.
And it seems like the public, when they are consulting the issue of intergenerational trauma, like you said, it can become an academic exercise. It can almost become an equation, intergenerational trauma plus person suffering from it equals this, you know, necessary solution or outcome. But that is all assuming that First Nations people are in a place where they can even engage with it themselves and reflect upon it themselves whilst they're suffering from it. Have I summarized that correctly?
Yeah, I would say so, definitely. And I think maybe an example here, a culturally appropriate one, might be useful. So I'm going to use suicide as an example because that is an issue that has affected my community for as long as I can remember and continues to affect my community. Growing up in the Cape, you know, death, in particular, death by suicide is considered normal. For me growing up, I didn't realize that, you know, suicide is this big thing that you don't talk about. It's this big shameful thing, you know. People lie in mainstream society when someone they loved, died by suicide. They hide it. It's this big shameful thing. I wasn't aware of that because growing up for me in the Cape, suicide was so, so completely normalized. My first experience with death was when my, 11-year-old brother's best friend committed suicide. He hung himself. He was only 11 years old. I had to process that at 6 years of age. And so did my brother, who was 11. You know, we're two children trying to process child suicide while being children ourselves. And you know, when other six-year-olds in Australia are, you know, dealing with the death of a grandparent or an uncle or an aunt or a pet, and that's their first experience with death, there are First Nations children like myself whose first experience with death is a child suicide, you know, and so it's because of those experiences that things like suicide become very normal for us. It's a normal experience, and so is death. It's very sad, but that's that example of intergenerational trauma that we're speaking to. You know, growing up in society, we're surrounded by death and violence, and then, well, in the Cape anyway, when I grew up, you attend funerals of people who chose to take their own life, and then you grow up thinking that that's normal and acceptable and okay to do. That's intergenerational trauma. That's an example of it right there.
And that's quite a modern example. And something you said before is that a misconception about intergenerational trauma is it's a historical thing. But so if I understand correctly, that if people start viewing it that way, they're creating the wrong foundation for the conversation to begin with. Would you agree that in talking about intergenerational trauma, the basis of the conversation needs to be something that revolves around it is suffered in modernity, and it is something that all First Nations people, we can reasonably assume all First Nations people are grappling with in a contemporary setting?
Definitely. I think the conversation needs to start with understanding that intergenerational trauma is only historical in the sense that it stems from colonization and what we experienced on day one. That's where it started. And it's just continued from then on and evolved to what it is today. And it will continue to evolve unless individuals like myself and other people I love and know, you know, are taking the stand and trying to end it and doing that hard, confronting work. But again, that's only possible when you have access to the tools and resources to be able to do that, which I do.
And so what do First Nations people need from non-First Nations people in this space? How can people be more supportive of First Nations people's ability and opportunity to engage with this and to find a sense of healing?
Depending on the space that you're working in, I think moving away from this idea that diversity and inclusion is this gigantic step towards reconciliation. It's not. We're not interested in diversity and inclusion. Well, me personally, I'm not interested in diversity and inclusion. I'm interested in decolonizing the systems that create an environment that lacks diversity and inclusion in the first place. Okay, otherwise known as decolonization. That's what I'm interested in. And I think what that looks like changes depending on your profession, whether it's law, whether it's medicine, whether it's, you know, architecture or the arts, etc., changes according to the profession. But at the end of the day, as I mentioned earlier, it's about having that compassion and empathy, but moving that from a passive place to an active place and taking steps, whether that's through creating programs in your workplace or in your field that aren't tokenistic, that actually lead to, you know, professional development and roles that are senior roles. You know, a lot of these programs only cater for entry-level positions or mid-level positions. There's nothing that caters to senior roles or, you know, executive-type positions. That's what we need. You know, I don't know. That's just what I think. And I think another example would be donating as well. So at the end of the day, it's about all of this involves giving up power and privilege, right? Not many people want to do that. We all talk about doing that. We post about doing that. But not many non-Indigenous people want to do that. But that's truly what it takes. It's giving up power and privilege to make space for the people who've had to minimize themselves and dilute themselves and live on the margins of society in their own land.
You've navigated difficulties with your mental health ever since you were a child. Please explain to us what the contributing factors were and how you have found the right support.
So I've been very private in my life. I'm a very private person. But I've reached a point now where I think it's really important to, in order to live more authentically and as my true self, I need to be very open, honest, and raw about what that journey has looked like. Growing up, I witnessed and experienced much violence, you know, dysfunction, death, and pain, not only within my family, but also my community. And this was a consequence of intergenerational trauma, which, as we mentioned earlier, began the day that Australia, or so-called Australia, was invaded. Since I was 7 years old, I've struggled with depression, chronic PTSD, suicidal thoughts, which is unsurprising given that, you know, suicide was normalized for me. And it was my first experience of death at 6 years of age. So it's only natural that at 7 years old, I'm going to think that's normal and not be able to understand that the thoughts that I'm having are actually really harmful and heavy, dark thoughts. As a child, I wasn't able to understand that. And people around me also weren't able to understand that because suicide was also normalized for the adults in my life. You know what I mean? And so I've had these mental health challenges because of things that I've survived, you know, child sex abuse, sexual assault, domestic violence. I turned to substances to cope with that pain, to numb that pain, and to escape from the feelings and memories of those awful experiences and traumatic experiences. I also used career goals and academic accomplishments to distract from that deep, dark sadness that I carried inside of me. And it wasn't until I was accepted into Berkeley a few years ago that I realized I needed to properly resolve this trauma and unpack it with a professional. Because even after being accepted into arguably one of the world's leading human rights institutions, I still felt like I wasn't enough. Like that wasn't enough. I still felt empty, and I still felt a deep sense of not wanting to be here. You know, I couldn't imagine my life after 30, because I didn't think I would be alive, to be quite honest. It was hard for me to imagine life outside of my 20s, because I just always had this inner sense that I wouldn't be alive and that I would succumb to the trauma and those deep, dark feelings. And so after that experience, that amazing experience of being accepted into Berkeley, and then sitting with that discomfort and that realization, I decided to work very closely with a psychologist who completely changed my life, And I think that because of the complex and multi-layered elements of intergenerational trauma, I think it's really important that therapy forms a part of the healing journey for First Nations people. And it's something that should be normalized. But there is this view that therapy is a very Western and, you know, white mental health concept. But it actually isn't. There's so much literature and research and evidence now, you know, that suggests that therapy is ours. Healing through talk is ancestral connection, you know, and I think more work needs to be done in this space and in normalizing therapy for First Nations people, and more importantly, making therapy more accessible to First Nations people in the first place, because accessibility is the key, right? How can we access something that is ours when it costs $185 to do so, you know, and that's just for one session? So I think therapy should play a really big part of Indigenous healing, acknowledging that it actually is ancestral connection.
On our International Women's Day podcast episode, we discussed the importance of role models to young First Nations women. Would you agree that this is an important factor in providing greater opportunities and outcomes for young First Nations women?
Definitely. For me personally, I felt there was a lack of diversity of First Nations women role models who were like me, you know, who were Aboriginal, who grew up in remote Australia, but who also expressed, you know, a diverse sexuality. There wasn't anyone like that around me. So I personally felt I didn't have anyone to look up to, and I had to carve out my own path. I think had I had someone, a mentor who modeled the things that I embodied or wanted to be, perhaps these things would have happened a lot sooner, you know, and not at the age of 29, 30, you know what I mean? I just think that there's definitely a lack of First Nations women role models who represent the LGBTQI plus space in the Cape. And I'm speaking only within the context of the Cape here, not other parts of Australia, because I know in Victoria, New South Wales, and even in Southeast Queensland, a lot of work is being done in that space, and the communities down here are doing amazing work, you know. But in the Cape, there's still that lack. And for a lot of people, I'm that person. And that was something that I only realized recently and was quite emotionally overwhelmed at that thought that, wow, I wanted that person so badly growing up. They didn't exist. I became that person. And now I am that person for other young girls in the Cape. You know, it's really humbling and it's such a privilege.
Do you think there's a sufficient amount of role models out there for young First Nations women now?
Again, just only speaking within the context of the Cape, I would say yes, for those who identify as heterosexual, you know, straight, and are cisgender, definitely, but not in the LGBTQI plus space, definitely not. There, it's actually really concerning.
What can be done about that lack of role models there?
I think that it comes down to increasing awareness within the community and also education as well, because some of the harmful myths that are circulating communities in the Cape is what's holding people like myself back from identifying openly within community. There's this view that, you know, for example, one of the harmful toxic views is that if you were sexually abused as a child, that's why you now express a diverse gender or sexual identity, which is just rubbish. The two are completely different. One is trauma, the other is genetics. You're born with it. You know what I mean? And so it's about educating people in community and spreading more awareness about the origins of, you know, blackfellas like myself. And for some communities in the Cape, we've always been there. You know, queer people have always been part of Indigenous communities. There's so much evidence to suggest that now. You know, it's been proven time and time again. And I guess that's why I'm now working in the space that I'm working in, because I want to be able to explore whether that's also the case for the Cape. And if it is, I want to demonstrate as well that we've been here. We've been here this whole time. We never disappeared, but it was only because of colonization and religion and all of those other associated, you know, accompanying colonial structures, oppressive structures, that we became invisible.
It seems to me that this lack of diversity in public representation of First Nations women has meant that many First Nations women could be feeling voiceless as a consequence. What effect does this have?
I think it can have a devastating impact. But I just want to, I guess, turn to the term voiceless, because I think sometimes that can be a little problematic in the First Nations space. So everybody has a voice, right? There's really no such thing as being voiceless. Everyone has a voice. The problem is there are things in place in our society that prevent those voices from being heard. So it's the job of people like me and others like me, you know, and others who aren't like me, who are First Nations and from the community, to use the privilege that we worked for as a platform to elevate those voices so that they are heard, they are acted on, and their rights are protected. I'm just the stage. I'm not holding the mic. It's important to pass that mic around. And that's what I essentially see my job as. I'm a platform to elevate those voices. I'm not the voice. They are not voiceless. They already have a voice. It's my job to get it out there.
Who are some other First Nations voices that you believe deserve some airtime and why?
A person that comes to mind is Dylan Mooney, who is a First Nations and South Sea Islander artist. Dylan is an incredible artist. He also identifies as LGBTQI+, and we collaborated last year on designing my research promotional materials in the Cape, and he put together some beautiful designs for me. I think someone like him is really carving out space in this area in a way that hasn't been done before, particularly when it comes to queer relationships between men, which is very, very taboo in the Cape.
As a grown woman, what advice would you now have for your younger self from the benefit of hindsight?
It really boils down to a couple of things. Firstly, remembering that you are loved, you are worthy, and you are valued. Okay, first and foremost. The other thing I would say is that, to my younger self, is that as you grow and heal, everyone you love is not going to support you on your healing journey, and you will outgrow relationships and connections as you grow into your best self. That's a sacrifice you make when you decide to be an intergenerational trauma breaker. But that's okay. It's completely normal. And not to let it deter you from your journey back home to yourself, because a life of peace and joy awaits, and it's worth the work that it takes to get there.
Marika, thank you so much for your time and for offering your perspectives and your experience. I hope to follow up with you again in the future, as you will no doubt now be immersed in another meaningful and interesting chapter of your life. Thanks again.
Thanks, Isaac.
Thank you for taking the time to listen. Marika's story is a deeply personal one, and I recognise that parts of our interview may not have been easy for her. The Cape York Partnership is grateful for her willingness to touch on vital issues by sharing her own experience. I'd like to remind all audience members that help and support exists for anyone who may have experienced uncomfortable or distressing emotions while listening to this interview. You can call Lifeline on 131114. Further contacts for support have been provided in the show notes. To keep up to date with future episodes of the podcast, please subscribe through your favourite podcast app. You can also follow the Cape York Partnership on Facebook and LinkedIn, where we post regular updates. We invite you to give the podcast a rating and review, which can be completed on the Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, and Stitcher apps. As part of the Cape York Partnership's International Day of the Girl campaign, the organisation has paired with the Our Sisters cause to raise money for Cape York girls' education. Visit the links in the show notes to find out how you can support the cause. This podcast is brought to you by the Cape York Partnership.